All right. Good morning, everyone. Hope everyone's doing well. Happy to see everyone here. Today we're going to be continuing with a discussion of second quantization. Before I actually do that, is everyone here? Yeah, more or less everyone's here. Let me first make a quick comment about sort of logistics about the tutorial this afternoon. The tutorial, I'm going to be posting the problems we're working on during the tutorial shortly before it starts, so sometime maybe around 3 p.m. And that is going to be on the same Zoom link that we're using now. Yeah, so that's it. So make sure that's clear. I'll also send an email about this later today. Okay, so where we ended last time, we had introduced these C dagger and C operators, which we defined C dagger using our Slater determinants. So the first thing I want to say before I get started on new things is a correction. So thanks to one of you pointed out that I had made a mistake in the normalization factor for the Slater determinant. Should be 1 over square root of n factorial, not 1 over square root of n, as I had written in during class. That's just because there's n factorial terms in the sum. So fortunately, this isn't too important because most Slater determinants are only important for introducing the C dagger operators, and for the rest of the class, we're never going to look at them again. Okay, so now let me start the new material. So we had introduced these operators, and we also introduced a many particle basis. Which has the zero particle state, then it has single particle states, then it has the two particle states, and so forth. Where these are all given by Slater determinants. And what we found is that each of these things can be written in terms of these C dagger operators. So the state with no particles is just itself. That's where we're going to start from everything from. Then the orbital phi 1 is what we get when we act the C1 dagger operator, which, remember, this is really C phi 1, but I'm using a shorthand, I just call it C1. So C1 dagger acting on 0 gives me the orbital phi 1. Likewise, C2 dagger acting on 0 gives me phi 2, up to Cn dagger acting on 0. So this is my one particle space. Then the two-particle space, this basis state here, that's a Slater determinant with phi 1 and phi 2, looks like C1 dagger, C2 dagger acting on 0. And we likewise get everything up to Cn minus 1 dagger, Cn dagger acting on 0. So this is my n-particle space. And then we can keep going like this. So we get C1 dagger, C2 dagger, C3 dagger acting on 0, et cetera. So we have our three particle space. And then finally, we have exactly one state where every single orbital is filled, which is just every C dagger operator applied in order to zero. So one thing that I want to note as a particularly sort of, it's a, kind of a subtlety, but it's important, is that this state versus the state C2 dagger, C1 dagger, zero, it's really the same physical state, but you should remember our commutation relation that Ci dagger, Cj dagger anti-commutator is equal to zero, which means that when I've swapped C1 dagger and C2 dagger, this state is equal to minus this state. So, it's okay to define their basis. With C dagger operators in any order. But you must be consistent. Otherwise, you'll have minus sign errors in all your operators.
Aaron, just very briefly, yes. How are orbitals defined in the free electron gas? Just because I can very well picture it in an atom, the order.
Yes. So when I use the word orbital, what I mean is any single particle eigenstate. So if you think of something like hydrogen atom, then of course the what we call orbitals are in fact the single particle. They're the eigenstates for one electron in the hydrogen atom, right? So likewise, in say the free electron picture, one orbital is one state, like if I look at phi k, which is my 1/√V e to the I. K dot R. This for any one value of the vector K, this is one orbital.
Okay. And in that sense, they then have their ordering.
Yes. Because you fill up one after the next. Yeah. And so, but you have to choose a conventional ordering. So there's like there's a natural ordering, let's say on the absolute value of K. But there is no natural order on the like angles of K, right? So in that sense, you have to make some conventional choice about what's the order you want, and then stick with that choice for the whole problem. Yeah, okay, so I'm gonna give you an example actually of this case sort of what it looks like to be consistent about this basis. So what we're going to do is we're going to return to the same example we were looking at last time, which is my three orbital system. And I'm going to find the matrix of C2 dagger. So last time we found the matrix of C1 dagger, which had mostly zeros, it had a few non-zero elements, but all the non-zero elements were one. This time we're going to find something different. So to do this calculation, we're going to find the action of C2 dagger in all the basis states. So the state zero gets mapped to C2 dagger zero. This is an element of our basis, so we're done. C1 dagger zero gets mapped to C2 dagger, C1 dagger, zero, which is equal to minus C1 dagger, C2 dagger, zero. C2 dagger, zero gets mapped just to zero. C3 dagger, zero gets mapped to C2 dagger, C3 dagger, zero, which is an element of our basis without doing any further manipulations. Then C1 dagger, C2 dagger, 0, gets mapped to C2 dagger, C1 dagger, C2 dagger, 0. This one is going to be 0, which you can see immediately because you have two C2 dagger operators and no C2 operator. So we're trying to add two electrons in the same orbital. But if you want to do this like very technically and sort of do the algebra carefully, then it will be helpful sort of just as good practice. We can use our commutation relation to turn this into this form, where we have C1 dagger, C2 dagger, C2 dagger. And now we can use the fact that C2 dagger squared is equal to 0. C1 dagger, C3 dagger goes to C2 dagger, C1 dagger, C3 dagger, 0, which is minus C1 dagger, C2 dagger, C3 dagger, 0. C2 dagger, C3 dagger, 0 goes to 0. And finally, the all-filled state also goes to 0. So now if I want to write down my full matrix, so we're going to get zeros everywhere except for the sectors that correspond to adding one particle, just like before. But now what we have in the first column, we have the state C2 dagger 0, so it gives us 0, 1, 0. Then in the next column, C1 dagger mapped to minus C1, C2. So this gives us minus 1, 0, 0. C2 dagger 0 goes to 0, so this is all zeros. C3 dagger 0 goes to C2 dagger, C3 dagger. So that's here with a 1. And then finally, C1 dagger, C3 dagger goes to minus times the all filled state. So this is my matrix for C2 dagger. And what I want to point out is that these two elements have this minus sign, which came from our commutation relations. But you can also think of that minus sign as being a reflection of the fact that this conventional ordering in the basis is very important. You have to make sure you pick a convention and stick with it. Okay, so this is where I'm actually going to leave for now our discussion of the like basics of second quantization. So we're going to pick this up again in the tutorial this afternoon and go a little bit farther with this at that point. But for now, if you have any more questions about just the sort of definitions and so forth, now's a good time to ask, and then we're going to move on to a related but slightly different topic. Okay, well, if there aren't any questions, then I will move on to the next topic, which is how do you write a Hamiltonian in terms of second quantized operators? By the way, if people who are watching and don't have their videos on would like to turn on their videos, that'd be great, and I highly recommend it. Okay. So we're going to return now to our free electron gas. Unfortunately, already had discussion about this, thanks to Anna's question. So we remember that our single particle orbitals are, as I wrote before, phi k equals 1 over root v e to the I k dot r, where this k is quantized in the way we discussed before. So we're going to build up our basis, just like we've done before. We have our zero particle state, and then we have our one particle states, where we have some k, so we have c k dagger acting on zero. And I use this curly bracket notation to indicate that it's a set of objects, so all possible objects that are of this form. Then we have our two particle states, and so forth. So this forms a basis for my whole space. Except that there's one thing which is actually a correction I need to make. So the correction is that we also need spin. Because I'm using correction in different senses before. It's not that there was any mistake before, just it's something that I'm not being careful about here. This particular line is not quite correct because they also need to include spin. So in fact, what we're going to introduce a concept which is often goes by the name of spin orbital, where we take our one orbital that we got from solving the Schrodinger equation, and we say there's actually two orbitals. There's one orbital for spin up and one orbital for spin down, because these are still orthogonal states. So there's actually two for every k, which are, I'll call CK dagger, CK up dagger, and CK down dagger. So these are two independent operators. So this creates an electron in orbital k with spin up, and this creates an electron in orbital k with spin down. These are often written as CK comma S dagger, and then S can be summed over between spin up and spin down. Or you'll also commonly see CK comma sigma. So either sigma or S are the two common notations. Okay, so now we know what our basis is. And we also know our many particle eigenstates we've found. Which are, in fact, just the basis states above. Okay. So what you should see here is that we have this. So this notation, I've introduced a slightly new notation, but we're using a product notation over these operators. So this just means apply all the operators that are in this product in order, whatever that order is. And so we have some, they're labeled by some I, which runs from the num. So I goes from 1 to the number of electrons that we have in the system. So we create, I should also label this sigma I as well, because this the spin also depends on which index we have. So basically I have n different orbitals. I multiply all these C daggers, and I apply H to this state. This is the state that has all those states filled. And then as we talked about in the very first day of the class, the result is that the energy of that state, this is an eigenstate which has energy, which is just the sum of all the single particle energies. So for every ki that appears in this product, we get this ki, and we take their sum, h bar squared k squared over 2m, and that's our energy of our many particle eigenstate. All right, does that make sense? Okay, so now how do we construct the Hamiltonian? I'm going to tell you what I think would be my first guess at constructing H, given this information. And then I'm going to take a totally different approach. And I'll have you prove on your homework that the two approaches actually are the same. But it's kind of a difficult thing to do. First guess is we're going to use the fact that if any Hamiltonian has an eigenbasis, or has a set of orthonormal eigenstates Vi, with energies EI, in that case, the Hamiltonian can always be written in this form. So this is a general fact about quantum mechanics, and so it should be true for our many-body system. So this suggests that I can write H in some way like this. We can also, maybe just to make things look a little bit simpler, let's just give this the name EI, since that's just some function of k. It doesn't really matter so much what exactly that is. So this would be my naive guess about how to write down the many-body Hamiltonian. So this is correct. This is not wrong. But it's also kind of awful looking. And so we're going to do a lot better than this. We'll say it's not exactly ideal. Okay, so there's a better way of doing this. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to tell you what the answer is, and then we're going to demonstrate that it works. Sorry, that's not what I want to say. I'm going to say it this way. Sorry, I'm changing notation a little bit. So this is the simplest possible form of our many-body Hamiltonian. It's a sum over all values of momentum and spin of the energy as a function of k times the ck sigma dagger operator times the ck sigma operator. Okay, so there's two ways we could prove that this is correct. So the first way is to show equality directly with this giant mess. And that's the thing I'm going to have you do in your homework. I'll give you some hints. So I think it's good practice for working with these second quantized operators. That's why I think it's worth doing. But what I'm going to do right now is a different method. I'm going to show that it has the correct eigenstates and energies. So if the operator has all the correct eigenstates and eigenenergies, then it must be the correct operator. Okay, so let's do that. So what I want to show is this. Which I didn't erase. So let's just try to write this down and work it out and see if it works. So we're going to act the sum of k and sigma of this, like whatever I wrote above, EK, CK sigma dagger, CK sigma on the state product over some I, CKI dagger sigma I, zero. So let's just, what we're going to do is we're going to go through these factors one at a time and try to pull them through this sum. So well, let's see what happens with let's say I want to look at the term EK, CK sigma dagger, CK sigma, CK1, sigma 1 dagger. So this is, K1 is some specific one that's in our eigenstates, and this K is just, could be any K, it's from the from our sum. So now we're going to use our commutation relations. Or let me do it this way. So, okay, we, our EK is just a number that comes through. Then we get CK sigma dagger. Then we're going to get delta KK1 delta sigma sigma 1 minus CK1 sigma 1 dagger CK sigma. So that's using my commutation relation. Now, I can also move this CK dagger through these operators. So in particular, this is no longer an operator. This is just a number. So that first term isn't doing anything particularly. So we have our first term, which looks like EK delta KK1 delta sigma sigma 1 CK sigma dagger. And our second term, now I also can, I'm trying to bring this, so our goal is to bring this operator to the left. So I still have it on the right of the CK sigma, so I'm going to bring it through. And that just, since the anti-commutator of C dagger and C dagger is always zero, we just get a minus sign. Okay. So what does this tell us? If we go back to our original formulation, original setup of the problem, we now have our sum over K and sigma. And I now have EK delta KK1 delta sigma sigma 1 let me write this a different slightly differently. I do want to say it that way. Sorry for the confusion. Okay, so what we've done is we've pulled one, the first operator from this product through our Hamiltonian. Now, what I'd like to do is actually just pull this CK1 sigma 1 out all the way to the left. But there's a problem, which is that this term no longer has CK1 sigma 1. However, if I have some operator that's indexed by K and sigma, multiplied by delta functions of kk1 and sigma sigma 1, then I can always replace k and sigma by k1 and sigma 1. So what that tells me is that I have C K1 sigma 1 dagger times this like that. So I've successfully pulled this thing through. I pulled the first operator through at the cost of gaining this delta function term. So we can continue doing the same thing. And what you'll find is we get something like this. So like pulling the next one through gave me another delta function term like that. And then if we just go straight to the end, following the same pattern, what we find is that we get product on I from 1 to n of CKI sigma I dagger. Maybe I should actually erase this right now in space. Okay, sorry about that. Okay, let me rewrite this more neatly to erase the thing. Okay. Okay, yeah, that's correct. There's only one more step to do, or actually maybe two more steps. So the first thing is this CK sigma dagger, CK sigma, now acts directly on the state zero, the state with zero particles. And C tries to remove a particle, so C acting on zero gives me zero. So therefore, this term now can just vanish. And now this delta function term can act within the sum on k and sigma. So the way I'm really thinking about it is that I reversed the order of these two sums. I view this I sum as on the outside and k sigma sum as on the inside. Then I use the delta function to collapse k and sigma. Maybe I can write that out. And then this sum, because of the delta functions, I'm just going to get this. I realized also my writing got kind of like smaller as I was trying to fit it on the bottom of the board. So I hope it's still big enough you can read it. Okay. Yeah. Okay. Good. Yes. And then this is actually what we wanted to prove, because this is this thing acting on zero is the original state, and this sum on I of E K I is indeed the energy that we claimed should be the energy of this eigenstate. So what we've shown is that this Hamiltonian, wherever I wrote it, on the other board, I guess, this Hamiltonian right here has all of the correct many-body eigenstates and eigen energies. Therefore, this is indeed the correct Hamiltonian. So I think that this is, I would say, quite important to make sure that you understand this because, well, first of all, the manipulation of the operators I just demonstrated in the proof is something which you need to be able to do. We'll work more in that tutorial and homework, so you'll have plenty of practice. And then this Hamiltonian, this form, it's important to sort of understand that this is the simple form that a Hamiltonian looks like. And we'll again see more of that in the lecture on Monday next week. I'm going to discuss a slightly more general version of this Hamiltonian and prove some properties of it that will be useful for us. Okay, so maybe so now I'll give you a chance to, yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, I usually like in QFT when we do these calculations from converting say P square by 2m into A dagger A, the Hamiltonian, while writing P and X in terms of creation and annihilation, we get a infinite piece where we have to do normal ordering, but somehow here means we didn't have to do anything like that.
So the difference is, I think, the concept of the vacuum is different, I think is really the reason. So this, like the normal ordering piece, where that comes in is basically this step right here, where I took this C dagger C acting on zero and got rid of it, threw it away. So like here, this zero is literally a state with no particles. So I guess that maybe what I'm saying is the mindset is different. In QFT, you have a mindset like there's actually a fluctuating number of particles. Here, we don't believe there's a fluctuating number of particles. There's a fixed number of electrons in the system. And the fact that this C dagger in C changes the number of particles is purely mathematical. It's not a physical thing that's happening. So like we're using these operators we're thinking of in the way that I defined them last time. They're just a convenient notation for writing down our many particle states, but there's no sense in which we actually believe the number of particles is fluctuating. There's no like infinite, there isn't an infinite vacuum to begin with. So like our vacuum, this state here, has nothing in it. And so it really is annihilated by this, by any C operator. So I think that that's sort of our equivalent to what you're talking about. Now there is maybe another, so, okay, you could make a slightly different definition here, which this is something which I'm not really planning to talk about in this class, but you can imagine that I have my K space, where I have Kx and Ky, and these are the filled states. And then out here are empty states. And in practice, basically all the physics we care about will happen in some region of K space that's like near the border between empty and filled. So I could define an alternate vacuum. So I could say, I could define that C K dagger product of K less than KF. This is this Fermi momentum we defined last time. The product of K less than KF of CK dagger acting on zero. I could define this as my new vacuum omega. And then in that case, if I rewrote all my operators and everything in terms of this omega rather than zero, then it would look, behave just like what you have seen in QFT classes. I think for the purposes of this class, there's nothing we're going to do that's going to require this picture. So I don't think that is useful to focus on. Okay, so there's before we finish today, there's one last definition that I want to make. So I'm going to define a new operator which is this combination C dagger C with the same index. And we're going to call this operator N. So this is called the number operator. And this has the property that N alpha acting on the product on I, C alpha I dagger, is equal to, in the exact same way we just proved above, to this. So this is an eigenstate. Every one of these same many-body basis states we've been talking about is an eigenstate of n alpha, and its eigenvalue is this sum over delta functions. But what this actually means, sort of if you put it into words, is the eigenvalue is 1. If alpha is one of the filled orbitals, and 0 if alpha is not one of the filled orbitals. So that's why it's the number operator. It counts, you look at a many body eigenstate, you apply this n, it says, is the particle there or not? If yes, 1, if not, 0. So it's counting whether it's counting the number of particles. So some useful facts. Most importantly is that number operators for different orbitals commute with each other. Let's see, what else did I want to say about it? And the other important fact that I want to point out is that n alpha squared is equal to n alpha. So this is something which you can prove directly from this fact about the eigenvalues and eigenvectors, or you can prove it with our operator notation. So it looks like, for example, C alpha dagger, C alpha, C alpha dagger, C alpha. And then you can use the commutation relations and simplify it down just to N alpha. Okay, so this is something that's useful to keep in mind. And that is actually where I want to leave our discussion of second quantization for the time being, and then we'll come back and talk more about what more general Hamiltonians look like in this language next week. So we do have a few minutes left in the class, and I want to take those few minutes to go back to something which I was talking about yesterday, and I sort of didn't know the right way to explain something yesterday about why Fermi energy should depend only on density and not on the size of the system. So I want to give a picture, I think, to explain this just quickly to sort of finish that discussion. In the meanwhile, while I'm racing the board, if there's more questions about second quantization stuff, now is a great time to ask.
I'm just looking at your notes, and at one point you say we could also lift the restriction on having N fixed. Would you do this in any context, just because you said, the mentality is more having a fixed number? Or is that
Yes, that is a good point. I did forget to say that. Yes. Okay. Let me. Right. Okay. So yeah. So the context of this is. So we've transitioned. From our original version of the Hamiltonian, then we wrote this complicated many-body thing. Of something like this, and then we transition to our Hamiltonian result, like sum of EK and K. So this one has fixed N particles. This one has no mention of the number of particles. So somehow, in going from the left to the right, this Hamiltonian is not actually equal to this Hamiltonian. They are equal within some restricted space. So this one is n particles, but it also acts in a non-physical space, or in more than the physical space. In the sense of symmetrization. And then this one has no restriction number of particles. So if I take this Hamiltonian and I project to the physical space, and I take this one and I project to only n particle states, then these two Hamiltonians are actually equal as operators. They act in the same space, and their action in that space is the same. So you may ask, though, in going from this point to this point, where did the restriction number of particles actually disappear? Like, I never explicitly said that we were doing that, but we did somehow. And so the trick is actually, it's all in this sum, which I say is sum over configurations. This could mean n particle configurations. Or it could mean all configurations. So in doing this step, what looks like one step here is actually two steps. We first convert this H into this one, but restrict to n particle configurations. And then we just say, actually, we're talking about n particle configurations, but forget about that. We'll just talk about all number of particles. It doesn't matter. So lifting this restriction is sort of an extra hidden step in going from the left to the right. Yes, yeah, so thanks, Anna, for bringing that up. I had meant to talk about that and forgot to do so.
Maybe just one more question, because if I understood you correctly, the mentality is that we define the zero energy literally in terms of number of particles and not in terms of, and I'm not sure when I say this, but I want to say like an external energy scale. That's at least the way I always thought about it in the quantum field theory context. Somehow that I just say, you know, this energy scale, at this point I say this is zero, but here we just say zero particles. That's what defines zero.
That's right. Exactly. So, well, the zero particle state is what defines zero. So it's like the picture I drew before. I don't remember what's on the board I erased or the other one. No, I guess it was on the one I erased. Okay, but basically where you have your filled states and then you have your empty states in K-space. The quantum field theory picture, that when you like define the zero point of energy, that definition is the total energy of all these filled states. That would be our zero point in that case. But again, we're just not going to think about that for this class. So you get different perspectives from different people in condensed matter. So you're getting my perspective from this class since I'm teaching it. And my perspective is, I don't ever think about field theory anything ever. So I do all numerics. And so everything for me is super concrete. And like, I can define exactly what every state is and exact zero point is no particles. Like that's sort of the way that I think about it, because that's the kind of research that I do. So that's the perspective you're going to get from me. If you took this class from somebody else, you'd get more like the quantum field theory perspective, I think. Okay, well, we're out of time or even a bit over time, but I do want to quickly make this argument that I was saying about the Fermi energy. And then there's also, I'm going to include a problem about this on the tutorial later, so to help also answer this question. So what I want to do is I'm going to suppose that I have two blocks of material, which each have some volume V and n particles. And each one has a spectrum of energy. And there's some Fermi energy. So these states below it are filled. And these ones are empty. So this means that, in sort of a single particle picture, which is not really accurate, but that's fine. We're going to forget for a minute about anti-symmetrization is what I mean. The highest energy any one electron has is EF. Now you imagine that you bring these two things together and they're getting closer and closer, but they're still separate. And suddenly they touch and they become one object. So that n goes to 2n, v goes to 2v. But the max energy of an electron shouldn't jump. Like, it would be very unphysical if we take our two objects and the maximum energy any one electron has is this E Fermi, and suddenly you bring them together, and then there's a bunch of electrons that suddenly have twice as much energy for no reason, even though it didn't do anything. So that would be a very unphysical thing to happen. So it's much more reasonable to claim that, in fact, the maximum energy each individual electron has remains constant. And instead, what happens is the density of states that are below this point gets doubled. So in the tutorial, we're going to actually work this out properly, and you'll see this is indeed what happens. OK, so I'm going to call that the end of today's class. And so we'll see you all for the tutorial this afternoon. I will send out problems shortly before then. And you can also join on the same Zoom link that we're using here today. Maybe one other thing I should quickly mention is you should have some software available for the tutorial where you can multiply matrices. I don't think we're doing anything more sophisticated than that today, but you will want that.
Okay, thanks.
Yeah, thank you.